Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for my podcast, Great New American Essays. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has this motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's spotlight is on the literary magazine Plowshares. I'm joined by the magazine's editor-in-chief, Ledette Randolph. Ledette Randolph has served as the editor-in-chief of Plowshares since 2008, when she has acquired numerous notable essays and short stories. A publishing professional for 30 years, she is a co-owner of the manuscript editing firm Randolph Wandering, and is the author of 5 award-winning books, including A Sand Hills Ballad, a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice book, and most recently, the novel Private Way. Thank you so much, Ledette, for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for asking me.
Absolutely. So tell us a bit about Plowshares. It's heritage and what you brought to the magazine as its editor-in-chief.
Well, Plowshares is one of the older magazines, not the oldest by any means, but it was started in the Plow and Stars Bar in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and that may be quite unique. And so it was founded in 1971, and from the beginning, it sort of grew out of a disagreement among the enthusiastic young people who were founding it. And so they decided to solve the difference in their taste by having guest editors. And that policy has continued from that founding. So we now have 2 of our 4 issues are still guest edited by prominent writers. What else can I tell you about the magazine? In 1989, it had a loose affiliation with Emerson College. In 2008, the merger was complete, and so we are now completely under the umbrella of Emerson College. I joined as editor-in-chief shortly after that. What did I bring to the magazine? Well, you know, big redesign, a 4th issue, which is a long-form issue. We've really brought the magazine into the 21st century with, digitization of everything and, you know, all of the kinds of ways that around 2008, things really changed in terms of ebooks and monetizing kind of those digital products, you know,
sure.
To use corporate speak. I have doubled the staff, and we have a $1.5 million endowment now that we accomplished during the pandemic. So, you know, I'm very proud of that, and I'm proud of the staff, proud of my wonderful board. And
sounds like your stewardship is going very well. That's a very nice size endowment. A lot of literary magazines would be probably, frankly, jealous.
I'm thrilled. We have very generous owners.
Yeah. So in terms of the essay form itself, over that period of time when you've been an editor, have you seen shifts in what's happening in the essay form?
I guess I can't speak with any kind of broad strokes there about changes in the form. Sure. I think that I have had more of a dedication to essays. The magazine for a long time was known as a for its fiction. And in its founding, we had great close associations with really amazing poets. So, you know, those 2 genres were very well covered. The essay maybe had been a little bit of a neglected genre. If I were to look back on, you know, the volume of how much we published, I always include some for the guest editors. I almost always publish some in both the long form and the winter issue. So that would be sort of my big overview of that.
Sure.
Of the essay.
Okay, fair enough. So you had sent me several issues, and I have some essays I wanted to touch on. One was, and the name I'll probably butcher, but Mihaela Mazgulik, her essay is Extractions. And
yeah.
I've spent some time in Romania, actually 2 different visits. So I know more than a bit about Ceausescu and very unfortunate policies, to say the least, regarding women's reproductive freedom and lack thereof. For your own sake, to the extent that you know the essay, what might be struck you about it that you'd like to comment on?
Well, I think, you know, it was a it's a very beautifully written piece. And I think it's sort of because it has, it takes the, it's from the position of a child who's observing these things. I think there's a great subtlety and sensitivity to it. And it's incredibly chilling. And it's also incredibly timely as we see, you know, threats to our own rights in that regard in this country. And maybe speaking, just going back a little bit to what you said, changes I've seen in the essay, I'm not sure that I've seen so much changes in the form. I just know that as a reader, that my own sort of interest has shifted as I feel that things are changing in this country, and that pieces that really pop for me are often pieces that speak to our own condition. So
yeah, the stakes seem to be going up and up. Sadly, but I agree with you. It was a very chilling, suppressed, you know, sense that there was danger lurking everywhere, and trying to read the tea leaves as to the extent of the danger. I was also taken with one of the details about the parades that are held, and the Romanian flag has three different colors, and the color leotard you did not want to wear as a young girl, the yellow one, which was essentially see-through, and depending on where you were in your cycle for the month, was really a source of embarrassment or discomfort. So that's a very subtle detail. You might not have gotten that 30 years ago, when the literary canon was probably a bit more dominated by myth, who would not have put that kind of detail in. But it's a telling one, and I was glad for it. It gave me a better sense of what she was experiencing. There's also a description of someone undergoing self-inflicted abortion, and that was tough reading. And this young girl, I'm not quite sure what her age is, but that'd be a hard detail to come across.
Was that the one? I believe that it was a woman.
Yes.
And it was a classmate's mother of this narrator, and she was a nurse. So she was, that was my, if I'm remembering correctly, it was a married woman with a child who.
Yeah, it's almost certainly the same one, because it was certainly the most excruciating set of details in the essay, involving a hot light bulb, a hanger.
That's a different one. Yeah, okay. There were two painful kinds of instances of this. So, again, I think we have been too reticent about talking about these realities. We've all kind of assumed this, we all agree, so we just won't talk about it. And so it was very important, I thought, that this essay really focused on that. And of course, I acquired this, or I sent it to the guest editor before the Dobbs decision. So, you know, we're far enough away now.
Sure.
But I think we all kind of sensed that something was percolating, you know, bad in the environment. So I felt like an important piece, and I was thrilled that Alice took it. So,
yeah, I know. And I know from my time in Romania, Ceaușescu started out as a reformer and ended up being an absolute autocrat, and the country fell into terrible straits. If there's any parallels, it just fills me with even more trepidation than I already had.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a common story, right? The person who's gonna change everything for the better.
So there's another essay. This is from summer of 2023. It's called Muting, by Victoria Gannon. And it ends up talking a great deal about housing, which is interesting because just today in the headlines is news that the Biden administration is trying to finally figure out some solutions to the astronomical increase in both renting and homeownership costs.
Yes.
So this involves in part some Apple billboards as the person's commuting into San Francisco. What might you want to say about the essay? Then I had probably a few details I was going to add.
Well, again, I felt like this was a story that it's easy for us to sort of think we understand So, you know, hearing it from inside that experience as artists who have been able, who were able to survive in San Francisco, in old San Francisco, but are increasingly marginalized, you know, as these changes happen. And of course, you know, the focus on the billboards is also a way of looking at why some of those changes have happened, you know, and also by looking at the ways that the photography, the photographs that she kind of looks at closely as the silhouetted person, so you could be anyone, was a way of indicating this could happen to all of us. You know, you think you're safe. She thought she was safe, you know, a middle-class white woman. But we aren't safe from this kind of rapacious late-stage capitalism. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And so I thought that it was just a really important story of this moment. It captured something of life in these cities that is becoming increasingly difficult for the creative class. And I thought that her ending brought it all back around, you know, the billboard again, the focus on the billboard, and the person is actually taken out of it.
Exactly.
Now they're advertising the machine.
Yeah, now it's all about the machine and the people who are renovating the properties and forcing her to go further away seem like machines to me, frankly.
Exactly.
Everybody is simply a BMR. They're reduced to an acronym, which for listeners means below market renter.
Yeah.
And she overhears them actually talking like almost like the Three Stooges because their rapaciousness is so evident from the overheard remarks, and they just are disregarding any sense of community or fairness or anything else. It's just a tough situation.
Well, so, we're widgets in the algorithms.
So going to the Widget 2324 issue, there were three essays, almost boom, 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 in the table of contents. It really struck me. The first one, I almost had to read the last part of the first section over to make sure I understood the implications of the last line, that the almost the most important character in the piece outside of the narrator is a dead person. it's the great grandmother.
Isn't that amazing?
It really was. I've not seen that in any essay I've ever read where a dead person was so prominent and so subtly but meaningfully introduced. It's called Minerva, and it's by Jesse Lee Kercheval.
You know, it really is. It's a ghost story. You know, and the last sort of sentence is so kind of shocking because she hears the firefighters who are coming on to the ice to help her rescue this woman who's trapped in an igloo. Long story, but they talk about the three figures they're seeing out on the ice, and there should only be two. It's really strange, and that's quite something. And of course, then you know the details of the flood that killed her great grandmother, and who is the ghost that she keeps seeing.
And you have the flood. You have another instance where the narrator is on a canoe trip and gets caught in quicksand and is fortunate to be saved, quite honestly. Then you have the igloo at the end where the other woman is also perhaps at the University of Wisconsin and thinks she wants to get out of the house because of COVID and builds an igloo that collapses on her. So there is just, you know, treacherous circumstances left and right, but they are so authentic and so unusual at the same time. Only that degree of unusualness would almost make you doubt the validity or the authenticity. But somehow I just don't hear. I am with her all the way.
Yeah, well, and Minerva, the great-grandmother, appears to appear at moments of great distress or near death experiences, and it happens in these three instances, one being her own diagnosis or facing diagnosis of cancer. So I think that also the details about the mother, her mother, and her reaction to her own childhood, and you know, it's a really rich essay for in a short space of time. She accomplishes a lot in that piece. So
I thought it was really striking, and I love the emphasis on mud, maybe because I like to think he said this when he was retreating from Russia, but Napoleon once apparently said mud is the fifth element.
Oh.
And I think a lot of times in life it is.
Yeah.
And I was happy to see that the goddess of wisdom, justice, law, victory, etc., Minerva, can be extended to mud as well, because I think that's just as important to life,
Right.
our understanding how it unfolds.
It's inevitable.
Yes, it is.
I live close to Vermont, and we're in the middle of mud season now, so
Yeah, well, I'm from
very
Minnesota.
real.
I had a friend who jokingly said we have a season called Sprinter, which is a combination of spring and winter,
Oh,
because
yeah.
there is no true spring in Minnesota, and some other places as well. Another one, changing scenery, but someone who also feels a bit oppressed, to say the least, because he's in prison. This is J.D. Matthews' On the Origin of Time and Meditation. So we're in a prison out west. It seems to me it's in Nevada, as best I can tell, or extreme
Somewhere
eastern
desert, north,
California,
southwest.
desert-like. He said, in fact, that it could be 1976, it could be 1876. It has not changed a lot, the landscape and the development. But there are two characters. There's Flat Five, a Black Delta blues player, and a man named Brew, which is short for Hebrew. So there's a couple of things I want to comment on, but again, I'd like to let you go first.
Oh, well, anytime I can get an essay like this from someone who has been through the experience of being incarcerated, it's really valuable. And for him to keep in check so much his kind of anger at the system, he does mention it, but he pulls himself back, and he makes this a bigger story than his own feelings of being persecuted, I think it's an incredible story about I felt like, as I was reading it, boy, do I misunderstand the experience of being incarcerated, because these were not superficial people. There was really a kind of education going on there in terms of music, and the way Brew talks about music in this philosophical way that was just kind of blew my mind. And so I always like to have my certainties or my sense of reality challenged, and this was really great for doing that. And also, I did think it was a kind of glimpse into a system, and seeing the ways that it just continues to degrade and to ask for impossible hurdles. And I thought it was, and I thought it was really beautifully written,
It
and
was really nicely written, and it was a very restrained voice that had its own dignity, even though it, indulged in, it's kind of some nasty asides about the system with vivid language. But there really was a dignity there. And I thought, to me, the thing that really struck me, at least in part, was, so they're trying, in terms of his conditions for getting parole, they're trying to make him go to church or be prudent. He's religious. They want to foster a certain spirituality on him. But he's actually finding in the music, because you're right. At one point, Bruce says, play one note and try to get inside it. And I thought that was so beautiful and so lyrical, and really a meditation. And this person, despite being, in prison, having apparently, I think it was a machine gun that he had used or made available to a friend or some such
He'd
thing.
helped someone. He'd been an accomplice in someone else buying a machine gun. He was a former military person, so he was probably more comfortable with those kinds of things than, someone who had not been in the military.
But nevertheless, you take someone who's in prison, machine guns involved, and you might have a very different set of expectations as to what kind of narrator you have. But I was impressed by the person and unwillingness to compromise, but not in a mean-spirited way, just wanting his own rights to be meditative. And right toward the end, he talks about the Paleolithic people and that we are sharing. There's a long span that links us as how we deal with darkness. And the darkness is, of course, not just literally night to day. It's the darkness of him being in the prison. And I thought that was a really strong close.
Oh, I thought so too. And talking about the early cave paintings and the hand created with the negative, by how we know spitting or blowing paint around the hand, that we interpret as a sign of their seeing, connecting with the dead on the other side of that cave wall where they thought that the other world began, and then comparing that to his own hand put up to glass, thick glass, with his wife at visitation, and just these ways that we struggle to communicate and to think about time. And I thought the meditation on time was just incredible. I thought this was just and his his allusions to other, to literature, you know, were so profound, and philosophy. And so without trying to be I didn't feel like it was trying too hard. I thought that these all grew out very organically, grew out of what he was trying to get across in this essay. So.
Yeah. I would have used that word organic myself. There's nothing pretentious about it. And the comparison of, you know, the Paleolithic are in caves, he's in a prison cell, he's at the glass wall. So there's an imprisonment. And have we really moved forward from, you know, stone and earth to, you know, cement and metal bars? Wouldn't seem so. So we have just time enough for one other piece. It's very short. It's what I call basically a lyrical essay by Sarah Twombly called The Difference Between Life and Death. I almost couldn't believe it. She goes swimming off the coast of Maine in the winter months, no less.
Well, I don't think she's swimming. I think she's trying to commit suicide, right? Okay. That was my interpretation.
One would have to think so.
Yeah. I thought that there was even something said along those lines where it's clear that I don't remember the exact way it was put. And it's no surprise she's a poet, because this is, again, a poetic.
It's a very poetic essay.
But again, it's just a beautiful meditation on water as the transformation of droplets of water and the ways they. Yeah, it was just such a great metaphor, I think, for a young person. I think she was 17 at the time this happened. Who wants to be lost, who wants to obviously just become a part of the elements. She's hoping that she can just disappear in the water and be dissolved in the water. And I thought it was really spoke to a profound kind of distress, mental distress and alienation from the physical body, that she just wants to destroy herself. And
there's a reference almost like her body's a raft of bones near the end. I was surprised she got so far out in the water. And I say that in part because being from Minnesota and having once stuck my toe basically into Lake Superior in May, I thought I'd lose it.
I know.
You know, it's so cold. I don't know how she, because, you know, if I understand it, you know, there's some fishermen who basically retrieved her out of the water. But it sounded like she was a ways out. And I don't know how, with the swells and the coldness, you even got 12 feet offshore. That's already an amazing detail, but the writing is the real hero here because it's simply incredible. There's one point where she says that the water, the way it beads, the way it gulps and roars, thunders and spits, the salt of it sings. I mean, I just went, oh my gosh, this is a writer.
Yeah. That's a poet.
That's a poet.
Often poets make great nonfiction writers, I find. You know, they can less successful sometimes in writing fiction, but they are quite often quite wonderful in writing essays and do bring that kind of attention to language and detail that I really value. It's not my only value in acquiring essays, and you've read them all now, so you know that that often. I will be very attracted to what I call a story of witness, you know, an important story that needs to be told. And if it's told a little bit, maybe less than poetically or beautifully stylistically, I still think it has its place in a kind of nonfiction.
Your merits. Yeah. But in this case, it's interesting because, you know, I've read more than a few prose poems, and somehow the poets who write in essay form I find more successful than the prose poems.
Yes, me too. Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
It would be that way, but it is.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you, Ledette, so much for being my guest. This is Great New American Essays. The focus this time has been on Plowshares. It's been my great privilege to have the editor-in-chief, Ledette Randolph, join me. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you, Dan.